It appears that tertiary syphilis can show up in several different ways, from no symptoms at all to frank encephalopathy or meningitis, which is very quickly kills people. But there is the one type, the type we were probably discussing, which is a progressive dementia that usually lasts, the average time is about 3 years.
Right.
And they don't have severe pain, but they have increasing psychosis.
Yeah, the thing that would speak against Nietzsche having tertiary syphilis is that he lasted quite a while in that state. Yeah, I checked that too, thanks. I forgot to mention it. And I found the same thing.
Yeah, because they say Robert Schumann had it, and he died within 3 years.
Did he?
And he had those increasing demonic visions, and they would be playing music really, really fast, and he was constantly trying to get it all down. And he died within 3 years after it.
But if that's an average, it could be that he did live much longer with it. And, of course, if there's some purpose behind it.
Yeah. The other thing, could you tell, from what you know of just medicine, this deterioration, I believe it's followed by tremors. Is that right?
Many times it is.
And I don't think his handwriting showed tremors. Mm-hmm. That's what people are arguing about.
Yeah, because it's usually the entire nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
Because doesn't it live dormant in the nervous system?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's becoming an increasing problem now that we have HIV, and so people, once they get immunosuppressed, are coming up with
yeah.
Really?
So becoming a problem again.
Wow.
Interesting.
Yeah. Syphilis going the way of gonorrhea, and that there are, it's becoming drug resistant.
I didn't read that. I read more about the immunosuppression.
Because I had read with gonorrhea, they are running out of drugs in some countries.
I'm
you can treat it now.
I'm sure that that's probably true. Because all of the bacteria suffer. If they are exposed, they're very resilient.
Mm-hmm.
They,
smart.
Yeah.
They transform very quickly.
Okay. Thanks very much, Ann. Well, that pretty much covers the first section of the first column on 339, this business of choice, freeing myself from the God. We might now say freeing the ego from the self, and how the self is both love and hate. It's both beauty and destruction. And all his sentences are partial formulations of a bigger picture, excuse me, of a bigger picture that they will hopefully fit into if you follow what we've been talking about. Is everyone okay with that? Well, Philemon speaks, and where Jung had just said, I got to separate, Philemon says, no. The God should not live in you, but you should live in the God. Again, not quite correct. What we would say later is you should have a relationship to the self, which is a kind of living in the self, or more accurately, it's being related to the self insofar as you are responding to its demands, fulfilling its intentions, living its path. And the other thing he says there, how, now that he's been through this, Philemon is keeping this language we've heard all through part one and part two, and he's losing it. He's losing that language. So what that means is the ego and the self are separate. And the voice of the self is coming through Philemon. But he is not that grandiose, bright, dominating, electrified person that he was in parts 1 and 2. And that's the way the self works. When it has been separated from, and I think he, as a, you know, as a doctor, had such a rigorous study that the ego and the self had separated. And now he's returning to it. When you begin to hear the voice of the self, it does tend to intoxicate.
Now you're confusing me a little bit.
Okay.
You said the language changed so that showed he was separating from himself.
Yes. Yeah.
And then just now you said he's reuniting.
Well, reuniting with... the irony is that when it comes time to separate from the self, it will possess you for a time, announcing itself. And then by hearing its agenda, it backs off.
Say that again?
When the self is seeking to be realized, it can usurp control of you and elate you or depress you, either way, because as far as the self is concerned, they're the same, to get you to pay attention to it. And then as you hear its demands, it backs off. In other words, another way to put it is, the way the self sometimes comes to consciousness is to re-identify with the ego.
And this would be a form of hubris, grandiosity.
Either hubris or despair. Remember, Jung called depression a negative inflation. Mm-hmm. I'm so terrible. And you want to say, you're not important enough to be terrible. Yeah, in our terribleness, we are terribly important people. So again, all the various aspects, union, separation, possession, being in, being separate from, all have a partial truth when seen as aspects of this process. That's what I wanted to get across. Yeah, on the intoxication, this might be time to just take a little diversion. What it's like when the self assaults is beautifully expressed by Nietzsche. I think I may have sent you this photocopy. I don't remember whether I did or not, but this is in Science of the Soul.
Yeah. page
54. Excuse me. I'll just read it because it's so beautiful.
This is Nietzsche you're talking?
Yeah. This is from Ecce Homo. Has anyone at the end of the 19th century a clear idea of what poets of strong ages have called inspiration? If not, I will describe it.
Here comes.
If one had the slightest residue of superstition left in one's system, one could hardly reject altogether the idea that one is merely incarnation, merely a mouthpiece, merely a medium of overpowering forces. See, that's the return of the self. The concept of revelation, in the sense that suddenly, with indescribable certainty and subtlety, something becomes visible, audible, something that shakes one to the last depths and throws one down. That merely describes the facts. One hears, one does not seek. One accepts, one does not ask who gives. Like lightning, a thought flashes up with necessity, without hesitation, regarding its form, I never had any choice. A rapture whose tremendous tension occasionally discharges itself in a flood of tears, now the pace quickens involuntarily, now it becomes slow. One is altogether beside oneself, and the distinction of consciousness of subtle shudders and of one's skin creeping down. With the distinct consciousness of subtle shudders and of one's skin creeping down to one's toes, a depth of happiness in which even that which is the most painful and gloomy does not seem something opposite, but rather condition provoked a necessary color in such a superabundance of light. That's what it's like when you get nailed with this stuff. It can be, or it could be the opposite. I can't take it, I'll jump off the bridge. But that had been the mood of Jung throughout at points in, you know, part one and part two, and now Philemon has got that and Jung has lost it, which means the inflation is subsiding. But he says, consequently, the last line, I was as if intoxicated. But now I notice that Philemon assumed a form distinct from me. So there we're getting images of integration. Okay, we change themes. Three shades. There's three ghosts. Now, here again, I think it helps to put it in context. If you remember, you might want to make a note, look at it in your spare time or not, but on page 294, way back, Jung was reading Thomas A. Kempis's The Imitation of Christ, which, you know, is basically says, as we talked about, the religious task is to be like Christ. Of course, Jung's answer is no, the religious task is to be like yourself. And he's disgusted with the book, and he's ready to throw it out. And what comes then are ghosts of the past, which he interprets as those Christian truths which are no longer valid, but which we also can't get rid of. So that's how I understand this woman who reappears here. She would be the portrait of past truths which are not true anymore on the level they were once taken, but he has to find the level on which they are true. So, I mean, for example, crucifixion is no longer for him an important historical reality, but it is an aspect of the process of individuation. He takes those truths and relocates them and sees them true on a different level. And I think that's who she is. Yeah, because one of the figures he talks to is a woman. They're at the very bottom of the first column on 339. The first figure was that of a woman. So it's a ghost. And what we'll be doing, we'll be contrasting her eventually with his soul.
She has sort of, she's kind of a scarab, isn't she?
And he links her up with the first part of the second column, 339, with the scarab beetle.
There's a beautiful section in this book by Ann Carson as well where she talks about why Eros has wings and the whole idea of wings beating and beating out the... I'll have to bring it in.
Yeah.
It's just really beautiful.
Yeah, please do.
She's talking about the whole idea of pleura and what that meant, breath, and what that meant, and the beating of the wings, that's the breath of God. And so,
Yeah.
An interesting concept. This was the ancient idea.
Well, I think it's very relevant because remember, the beetle is the form of God in his process of transformation during the dark phase. Well, I think that's saying in another way what I just said, that this woman is bringing back to him those truths of a previously existing God, understanding of God, that will not go away. And why I think this is so important is Europe is about to embark on existentialism, in which there is no God. And Jung, as far as I can see, is the sole voice in Europe saying that understanding of God should die, but we can't get rid of it altogether. As far as I know, nobody else talks like that, except Nietzsche. But Jung then is carrying Nietzsche's idea of the death of God into the rebirth of God.
I wondered when Philemon invites him down into the grave of God, you know, to actually experience the death of God.
Yeah.
I wondered if he was trying to make some statement there about the death of the old God.
Well, at least that he's gone through it. Remember, he was a preacher's kid. And so in that spirit, she says, it was night when I died. Now, I don't know for sure what that means. I'll tell you what I think it might mean. Is this Christian world was once alive for you, and it's now dead, and it died in his confusion and despair. That could be the personal aspect. If it has a collective meaning, it's at this point in the Western cultural mind that more and more people said God is dead. Otherwise, how could we have World War I? World War I was the beginning of what they called the death of God theology. I want to just review World War I a bit. I just remember, you know, a million people were killed in one battle. Battle of Verdun. That's like Indianapolis. Gone in a couple of weeks in one battle. So that made such an impression on the Western mind, or the European mind, that the only thing people could say, well, there's no God. And that really set the tone for the next step. What, 100 years probably. I think only now are some of the more articulate poets and writers and playwrights returning to that question that there might be a God. But Jung wouldn't let it go because he, I think, had experiences like this where that ghost is making demands. And as I said, the demand is to live those truths, and what Jung is saying, but I determine the level on which they're true. Mainly, the developmental process. They're all relevant in the process of maturation.
Is there any evidence, or has anyone ever given any credence to the idea that maybe some of this dialoguing that he was doing with female figures like these ghosts might have been going on with Tony?
I don't know. Not that I know of, Carl.
She was kind of a spiritual...
could be.
I was feeling that might be possible in this coming section where he's sort of back and forth with this sort of mysterious semi-soul woman.
I go more with Tony would be on the side of the soul. That she's his link to human warmth. Mm-hmm. Because this woman, as we'll see, is pulling him away from the earth. Now, had he listened to her, he would have committed suicide.
This woman.
Yeah. So. But she's not false. She's just not historical.
But it would be quite possible that this is 1916, I think. Now,
yeah.
That he would be share some of these dialogues with Tony.
Oh, without a doubt.
And that,
that I'm sure
she could be providing a kind of therapeutic.
Yes.
Soul alternative.
I think so.
Okay.
I would say without a doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know, but I'm guessing Emma Young could not follow this.
Sure.
Even her book, which is really quite wonderful, The Grail Legend. I just feel the mind that works with this material at that level just wasn't there. She was practical, caring, warm, but that this wacko imagination, if I can put it like that, was foreign. And it's foreign to most Swiss. I mean, they're rooted, they're mountain people. And, you know, they don't fantasize. They shovel snow.
So much is represented by their of the psyche in a way, so represented by their country too.
Yeah.
Nietzsche gravitated to those things too.
Yeah. Okay, so that's my take on It Was Night When I Died. And I like what she says. There are still days, years ahead of you. What will you begin? So, on the one hand, she's pulling him away from the earth. On the other hand, she's giving him an assignment. Then, what she says is she wants the symbol, which is the birth of dream work. What he is given is hap. Now, hap, we are told is in the footnote 44, is the son of Horus. And before that, we're told of Wallace Bunch, who's an Egyptologist, that the phallus of his pepi is hap.
What's pepi mean?
Well, that's a good question. As far as I can tell, it's the name of one of the pharaohs. It's actually it's pepi 1, pepi 2, pepi 3 of a dynasty.
They were such names.
Of a pharaonic name. Now, why it's the pepi, I'm not sure. Or his pepi, I'm not sure.
Did we identify Hap as that dream he had in childhood?
Yes.
The phallus?
Yes. And if you look here, there's two references, footnote 44 and page 340, he comes back to it. Where hap is used here, in the black book, the word phallus is used. And then it's a C.F. Jung's childhood dream of the ritual phallus in the underground temple. Do you all remember that dream? Sure? Okay. So that would be his creativity. Phallus, not purely as sex, but as the creative member.
I looked him up online in the Egypt Book of the Dead stuff, and he was a god of navigation.
Ha.
Yeah,
was he?
The navigator. So that's kind of interesting to bring those along with the same.
Yeah.
And a great runner.
So what he's getting is creativity.
Yeah. The path to creativity.
Path to creativity. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's how I understand.
It's going to help him get to creativity.
And, you know, Carl, there'll probably be, I don't know how you women would see this, but this is not traditional masculinity. And it takes swallowing something to realize the standard idea of athlete doesn't interest me. This is his masculinity. And remember the dream that Gerhard Adler had when hearing Jung lecture, that one of Jung's, I think his right foot was crippled. What it means is coming to terms with a different grasp of masculinity, which a lot of people just think is being a wuss. That might be part of what's going on here, too.
Is that what he means, like God's other pole?
Let me see, where is that, Jane?
That is the half the symbol that we desire, that we needed. God's other pole, that is precisely the pole we needed.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'd be inclined to say yes, that the divine task, or the task that comes from following the self for him, is creativity. And in that sense, it's an aspect of the religious life that we don't acknowledge. Which is absolutely crazy when you think about what, you know, at least our biblical portrait of Jesus. He wrecked everything. But masculinity is generally assumed to be, and the good life is generally assumed to be, supporting the status quo. Let's look at the cars in this parking lot. So I wonder if part of this is he's redefining what masculine is for himself. It's creativity. I remember when I was dealing with this in my own development, I had a dream of a woman bringing a javelin to me, and she wanted to see how far I could throw it. I had to tell her, I throw a different kind of javelin. It's realizing that's my masculinity.
Would this masculinity then be shared by both sexes, in the sense of being a creative force?
Yeah. But it's largely not part of collective consciousness, I think, is what he's dealing with.
And to me, that creativity and relationship are close, because the more you can be creative in relationship, the more other possibilities of relating and being.
Yeah.
And I think that's what the whole movement is today, with the inner. You know, you don't relate to each other necessarily just like the rules say. So, you know, they're saying, no, I want to marry who I want to marry, a man or a woman.
Yeah.
So get the hell off my back.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And my definition of relationship is much broader, richer than, or than I just, I don't know, I think that, you know, people won't like it, but
I hear you.
Healthy.
Yeah.
So I think that creativity and relationship are real.
It's certainly changing.
Are you sort of equating relationship with the feminine and masculinity with the masculine at this point?
No.
No,
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. a relationship with feminine creativity with the masculine.
Well, I can.
Is that what I said already?
Let's see. If I understand what. You're not equating either one of those. I mean, as long as it's gender free. I mean, I think a woman can be masculine and feminine. I think it's and masculine.
Yeah, well, we're not talking about.
Yeah. And
talking about things that apply to both genders here.
Yeah. Well, I think the woman can be creative. She probably is more creative in general in relationships. That's what she's getting at.
I'm just exploring this idea that's growing out of the idea that masculinity leads to creativity.
Yeah, well, if I understand what you guys are saying, I would frame it this way. Actually, the creative masculine is the highest development of the masculine, which both men and women share. But it's not collectively seen as the highest form of the masculine. But apropos, your things are changing. I got to tell you guys a story. I just cracked up yesterday. I'm taking this class at Butler, and how things are changing. Every once in a while, something hits me there as, oh my God, we are changing. The teacher was giving an illustration. Now, if you are doing this, it's largely a class of women, and your boyfriend does this, the girls raised her hand and said, or my girlfriend, accepting, hey, let's not define what relationship is. I like that.
Yeah.
Things are changing in that regard. And I think that sort of personality would be more likely to accept that creativity is a form of engagement in the world, at least as or higher than brute strength. Because brute strength for the man and the cheerleader idealizing the brute strength has been the basic paradigm.
And wouldn't you say, I mean, in Europe they felt this learning or the wolf, you know, the wars brought about really no gain.
Right.
Economically, anyway.
Yeah.
In any way you look at it, this destruction. So power was already.
It's already changed.
As a value, that works or that brings more healing. You know, just raw power, force against force doesn't work anymore, and we don't know so much because we didn't have that.
Absolutely.
Destruction across our whole.
Well, you've heard me go on about this movie, Midnight in Paris. Remember the love interest at the end? I became fascinated in who she was. Maybe I told some of you this about what she said about Americans and French. She's French, but her name is Léa Seydoux, and she was sent to summer camp in New Jersey from the age of 10. And so she was comparing French and American styles. And what she said was, in America, it's always important to be great, to be active, but in France, we want to see your vulnerability. So that's exactly what you're saying. And that vulnerability is, and creativity, are linked. And I think that's what that's an aspect of what he's dealing with here. So that's HAP.
The non-traditional masculinity.
Non-traditional, creativity, and I just sort of went off on because that was the initial I've dealt with, that it is not traditional masculinity. Now, something else that we're going to be dealing with is what does it cost him to live his creativity? And that's where he says things like, he is the extract of all bodily juices. See where I am.
That's Hap.
That's Hap. In other words, Hap is extracting my life from me. It's costing me a lot. The spirit of the sperm, the spirit of the sperm in the entrails of the genitals of the head, of the feet, of the hands. Actually, sorry, that's the dead one speaking. Doesn't matter, that's the truth, no matter who says it. And then I think a blockbuster sentence, which I would cite to justify the approach I've taken throughout this whole work. By the way, you know, we're on our 104th hour.
Feels like it, huh?
With the red book?
No, it doesn't feel like it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, with the red book. It's just that's the longest thing we've ever done.
Really?
Yeah, I think the Mysterium, we stopped at 100 hours. I think this is our 52nd meeting. The enlightening thought comes from the body. Now, see, that's an indication of integration. Let's see. He's.
I got it.
You got it. Before, you see, we had Salome and Elijah. We had the old man in the forest and his young daughter. Here they're together, and that's what is. That is part of the fruit of what he's going through. He can't separate creativity, sexual desire, body, emotionality, and creativity. They all belong together. Another way to put that is the split between spirit and matter has been solved. Matter would be the body, the thought, meaning creative thought, go together.
Is that why they capitalize Hap? I just thought that was interesting.
I don't know.
In the footnote, it doesn't capitalize every letter in the word.
Uh-huh.
And up here it does, and I just thought, well, okay, but then what she said.
I think we're safe saying Hap equals phallus because of the second footnote.
Is it an acronym?
Well, according to the editor, no.
It's capitalized the way Philemon is capitalized, except using Arab Roman letters.
Let's see, what would that be? There's no H in ancient Greek, is there? There's aspirated vowels. There would be an A with a little line before it. Does that sound right? Does anyone know Greek? I think that's the way Greek is. For ancient Greek, anyway, there's no H. There's no H in French. They have a hard time saying happy. They'll say happy, unless they worked on it.
I don't think there's an H in Italian either. Hotel for hotel. Uh-huh. Hotel.
So, I don't know. Unless he's just emphasizing it.
I mean, they do use an H, but it isn't.
Yeah, it's not spoken. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't say herbs. We say herbs. The H is silent. That's the romantic influence.
But if it's a man's name, we say herb.
But if it's a man's name, we say herb. Yeah. Because in French, oh, well, you don't care. sometimes you put the liaison, and sometimes you don't if it's an H, and that's why. Some are one and some are the other. I don't even care anymore. I care, but it's just impossible. You learn the rules, and then every sentence is an exception.
Yeah, that's what they say about English.
English, you know, we don't realize how hard English is to learn. For us, it's the verbs. Each verb has to fit into a certain pattern, like, well, never mind. It's hard. It's really, really hard. Yeah.
And she describes this thought like a worm.
Right.
A serpent.
You see, I think we're seeing now the idea that the mind isn't high and the body low, that the mind is dealing with fundamental biological processes and emotions, sex, power, rage, lust, sadness. Thinking that the mind is something above that is one of the things he's had to give up. And not only that, that thought process drinks blood.
Now, is he making a distinction here between mind and thought? And word? I'm just...
No, but I would say when he says thought, he means mind.
I would make a distinction between those.
Yeah, intellect and mind, thought and mind. Intellect is this detached process. The mind grasps an experience by whatever tools are necessary to express it. Poetry, whatever it takes to communicate, where the intellect has rules, the mind communicates with all its tools, the experience that's moving the individual. Jung had a mind, Nietzsche had a mind. Philosophy is largely intellect.
It's interesting. So the thought is a serpent. It just makes you think of the kind of thoughts that come from the reptilian aspect of our brain.
Yeah.
They're doing a lot of studies on that right now, how the unconscious works neurologically.
Yes.
Are you reading any?
No, but...
What, logically?
Neurologically. They've made some estimation of how much of our actual functioning is done by the unconscious, and it was some huge amount of what we do is simply governed by the unconscious and not conscious at all. Mm-hmm.
Which would be reptilian?
Some of it. Let's see. Reptilian part of the brain is governing the sympathetic nervous system and your reactions on that sort of gut level. Is that right?
Yes. See, what Nietzsche described, that's reptilian. What Nietzsche described is how his creativity seized him. That's reptilian. But this being seized by thoughts which aren't linear in order to express an experience is what I would call mind. And it starts from the physiology, and that costs a terrible price to the body and to life. Now, we're just about out of time. I will mention something which we'll pick up with next time, this blood bit, which we're going to see a lot. We've talked about it several times. I went back and I dug up the quote from the visions. For those of you who are interested, it's on page 243. Sometimes one is allowed by the gods to substitute wine for blood, but that will come later. We'll talk about that next time. How, in order to have a certain thought of any accuracy and potency, it must come out of a certain experience. And that experience can be devastating. That's the price we pay. Sometimes we can avoid that, but often it's not up to us. But we'll return to that idea, because we're going to see him go on, maybe even a little histrionically, about the blood. Two, I think, which I'll try to tie in, remember the slaughter that's going on in Europe just as he's writing this. And there might be a relationship between the blood he feels he has to pay for his work and the blood being spilled in the war. But what I just would like to leave you with is how we moved into creativity and the body, and then the cost of it, and then we'll pick up with that next time. Cost of it, here's the blood. Thank you for hanging in there. Well, I had you read to 3:45. Yeah, we won't get any farther than that. So no extra reading. I got to the bottom of 3:44, 3:40. No. Where did I get? I got to the first column on 3:44, and I was exhausted.
It exhausted me.
So if you didn't get this far, at least go up to 3:45. We probably won't even get there, but you'll have that under your belt. But hopefully it's worth the effort to probe this stuff. Imagine what it must have been like to write it. Yeah. Okay, thank you. See you in 2.
Thank you, Gary.